I think now is a good point for us to end this first half in about 5 to 10 minutes. I'll send you a second link. If that won't be on Twitch, it's going to just be for patrons only. And, and that one we'll talk about, like, some of the ways that the superego was being acted out. We did this now already, but some of the other ways that the superego function might be acting on society under COVID and, you know, about Trump and that kind of thing.
Great. That'd be fun.
The most orthodox of all Marxist economists I have ever met.
The reason why I'm still a Marxist is that I claim that this structure of belief, of displaced belief, you find it in what Marx described as commodity fetishism.
That all really dialectical and intelligent human beings will have a sense for evil and some sympathy for the devil, or they will be just a little stifled and bored. I think that's not wrong. Just a little sympathy for the devil will hurt.
Inside Critical Theory brings you this Diet Soap interview.
Hello, Diet Soap viewers, listeners, and future readers. We're recording this conversation on Thursday, December 9th, 2021, and the guest today is Todd McGowan. McGowan is the author of Emancipation After Hegel, and he is a lead author for our new publishing company, which is Diet Soap Books. His book, Enjoying Right and Left, will be coming out next year. But today we're going to be just talking about Freudian concepts and Lacan and Hegel and Zizek in a kind of general way. Todd, thanks for coming on to the
new thanks for having me,
podcast.
Doug. I appreciate it. Yeah,
I appreciate you letting us publish your book and coming on the channel. I wanted to ask you about being a Freudian today, because this is something I run into sometimes, and I'm not as learned on Freud and Lacan and Zizek as you are. So sometimes I have trouble defending my interest in their psychological approach or their approach to human psychology. Mm-hmm. I find them convincing and compelling, you know, when I read Freud or Lacan. Well, when I read Lacan, I find them inscrutable. But when I read Freud or Zizek, I find them compelling. But Freud has largely been rejected, I think, by contemporary psychologists. How do you justify continuing to follow and develop Freudian ideas?
Yeah, you know, so I gave a talk on Freud and Citizen Kane at University of Vermont, and my dean, who I like a lot, is a psychology professor. And after I gave the talk, he said to me, he's like, it's interesting how you can make that useful when it's totally, for us, it's totally outdated and useless. And I thought, oh, that's a strange kind of compliment, but that's not really one. But but I thought that I guess what I would say, and I say this to all the, I have a psychology student that's come into my class of mine. I'm like, look, buyer beware. This is not what you're going to get over there. And so part of me just plays a kind of pluralist game and says, like, they're doing one thing in psychology and we're doing a different thing. But I also think that, I guess for me, like the certain Freudian notions, I don't think have been surpassed in any way. Like unconscious, the one that we're going to talk more about today is superego, which is, of course, related to the unconscious. Like, I think that psychology has gotten rid of those ideas at its peril. So I think that I guess for me, like, I would just say to someone that said, well, Freud's outdated, I would say, like, well, explain to me a concept like Donald Trump without recourse to things like unconscious and superego, just to choose those two, right? Which are an unconscious understood in Freud's way, right? And I think that's really important, because people in psychology still talk about unconscious, but just in a purely dynamic sense, like it's just what's not present to consciousness. Whereas for Freud, I think, and I follow him totally on this, that it's he calls it an other scene, right? Like it's a place that has a logic different than that of consciousness. And that's what psychology doesn't really, non-Freudian psychology doesn't really have a place for. And I think that helps us to explain aberrant, what seem like very aberrant behaviors that otherwise would be inexplicable. So that's what I guess that's my defense of Freud, that he helps us explain what otherwise seems inexplicable, other than to say like there's some kind of brain disorder, which seems not helpful.
Yeah. So I'm not trained in psychology. I mean, I've taken some undergraduate courses in psychology a long time ago now. So, I'm not sure if what I'm about to say is correct, but it seems to me that the realm of psychology has become mostly an empirical science. In other words, and which isn't bad, but it's based on statistical analysis, maybe.
Right. For sure. Like, I mean, the psychology, like at our university, the most fecund part of psychology is neuroscience. So it's very much like, and it's, so it's based in, even in physiology and biology, right? So even, so definitely like it's, psychology aspires to the hard sciences. I think it's like most of the social sciences in that way. Like it aspires to empirical analysis and tries to find a way to root its insights in empirical analysis. And so I think I think you're absolutely right to say that. And whereas Freud is a speculative thinker, right? Like he too had science as an ideal, but I think what's great about him is that he's a speculative thinker on the level of Marx or Nietzsche or Hegel or all these other people. Right. So I think that's why we find him interesting.
So so Freud has sort of been moved into the realm of philosophy.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And yeah, although that's interesting too, because philosophy departments, at least here in America, would never teach Freud, right? Just like they would never teach Marx or Hegel. So that's a whole other conversation.
The one that's really difficult to understand as to why they don't teach him is Hegel.
I mean, right.
You know,
right.
Marx, I understand. Marx isn't didn't consider himself to be, and certainly most Marxists wouldn't consider Marx to be a philosopher. That's right. Almost a slur against Marx.
It would be a slur, right.
Yeah, right. And Freud, similarly, is supposed to be in the realm of even medicine, you know.
Right.
But Hegel, not to teach Hegel, that's an odd choice, you know.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the feeling that, and I think it actually comes down to his attitude toward contradiction, right? So for them, like it's so, for at least analytic philosophy as it's developed in America and in Britain, it's so focused on the logic of an argument that I think Hegel's his dialectical way of proceeding runs counter to that. I think in that sense, I think the rejection of Marx and Hegel is of a piece, because it's a rejection of dialectics and analytic thinking versus, I mean, Hegel even lays it out, right? He lays out the difference between analytic thinking and dialectical thinking. Mm-hmm. And so even though he of course couldn't anticipate analytic philosophy, basically it develops that line of analytic thinking that Hegel was already theorizing. So I feel like that in that sense, their rejection of him makes a lot of sense. Although there is, I should be fair to say that there is a whole movement within the American tradition to bring Hegel into that. And it's basically to Kantianize him, to make him much more proximate to Kant. So thinkers like Robert Pippin, Robert Brandom, it's kind of known as the Pittsburgh Hegel, but it's basically a Kantian, more Kantian Hegel. So, and Hegel is a philosopher of like the limits of what we can say about human experience, right? So, so much more, and that even sounds like Kant. So it's much more about a kind of like turn, like eliminating that speculative, ontological, political dimension of Hegel.
I mean, it seems to me you can't do that to Hegel, because Hegel's whole critique of Kant was that the limit that Kant placed on human cognition demonstrated a transcendence of itself, that by knowing where the limit is, you already have demarcated both sides.
Doug, it's exactly right. Like it's rough. You're quoting almost verbatim the Encyclopedic Logic, where he says, you know, to identify a limit is to go beyond the limit, right? So that's the problem. Yeah.
Right. All right. So to get back into Freud here, to jump in with both feet, I would say that if you were going to try to teach Freud in the realm of philosophy, you might teach Freud alongside or after you taught, actually, strangely enough, the empiricists like Berkeley and Hume and Locke, who, because they were, you know, concerned as theorists of consciousness and, you know, as philosophers with the problem of cognition and the problem of human subjectivity.
Right.
And Freud is coming up after them and historicizing, in a way, human cognition, or at least contextualizing it within social structures and within a lived, you know, experience.
Right, for sure, for sure.
Yeah. So now I guess we should start in on the superego. So the superego, I guess the question I'm going to ask, it's not written down, but to follow up with where we're at, is the superego for Freud of the product of a particular kind of family life, a particular kind of human existence, or is it intrinsic to and transhistorical?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think the latter. I think it's not particular, but I think there are certain historical epochs that that are more superegoic than others, right? Like I think interestingly, the capitalist epoch, which Freud is obviously theorizing out of and in, is the most superegoic. So he only, and it's fascinating that it's only in 1922. So he's very old. He's in his 60s. It's only maybe 70s. It's only then that he's able to theorize superego. So it's capitalism is already, so we've already had World War I, right? And we're in the boom of the early 20s, and he's then theorizing superego. And I think that's not accidental. Like, I think that there's something within capitalism that is especially superegoic. And I think it's interestingly tied to this demand to accumulate, right? Like to both for the producer and for the consumer, like for the producer to accumulate more capital, for the consumer to accumulate more of whatever enjoyment in the commodity, right? So, so I think that dynamic in capital allows him to invent or discover, however you want to put it, superego as a concept.
So Freud has these three parts to the human mind: the id, the ego, and the superego.
Right.
And whenever I try to think about the way the human mind is constructed under Freud, I end up thinking about a comedy sketch in a show called Mr. Show, where they're acting out a scene on a subway car, and there's a psychiatrist who is giving commentary on the scene. So every human mind has just like this subway car, has a human, you know, has a couple and a nun and a mugger and everyone's consciousness.
Yeah.
And so I kind of think of the id, the superego, and the ego like that. Like, they're each one's like little individual characters on stage. Sure. But that's not how I should think of it, right? That's not probably what...
Right. I mean, so a couple things. So Freud's first, so he has his first way of understanding the psyche in three parts is unconscious, pre-consciousness, and conscious, right? So that dominates his thought for the first, I don't know, 30 years of psychoanalysis, right? So that, or almost 30 years. And then he comes up with what you just called the structure, what you just identified, the structural theory in 22-23. And that theory, like, I think you could think of them as like individual actors within the psyche. I don't think that's terrible. The problem is, I think that when we do that, we tend to misidentify, I think, what they are like. And one of my sort of pet peeves is about the way Trump gets identified with, we always hear this, the American id, he's the unleashing the unconscious worst aspects of America, whatever. But I think he's much more the American superego. And I think that often when we try to identify them with a particular kind of person, we misidentify them, like the way superego gets identified with parent in this kind of very vulgarized Freudian, like the it is the child, superego is the parent and the ego is the adult, right? Like, I think that's a really vulgar and completely misleading way to think of superego, because I think what it misses is the way that superego is this, it's a demand that we confront for constantly more obedience to some kind of social regulation, which isn't necessary. It's not, and I think the irrationality of that demand is not captured by the notion of parent or even by the notion of the nun, even maybe by the nun. I don't know.
Depends maybe by how, the mugger, or it could be the
right. Right. I like the mugger. Right. That's right. What I was going to say. Like, I would like the nun to be the figure of the id and the mugger to be the figure of the superego.
Yeah. I mean, there are more characters added as the sketch goes along, the psychiatrist himself becomes a character in your own consciousness.
Yeah, that's good.
So, yeah. To go back to what you said, there's the preconscious, the unconscious, and the consciousness itself, right?
Yeah.
So if we were to connect those categories up with the id and the ego and the superego, how would it go? Would it be preconscious was id?
No. Freud's point is they don't line up, right? So each structural category, so id, ego, superego, each has conscious, preconscious, conscious dimension to it, except he thinks the id is almost entirely unconscious. So that's the one category. I mean, most of them, it's safe to say that it's only ego that has any consciousness and preconsciousness, right? Like, superego and id are basically unconscious. Like, nobody thinks to themselves, like, oh, I'm going to submit to my superego here. It's not a conscious decision.
I sometimes do.
Okay, maybe. But I think when we think we're doing that, I think we're often submitting to something else, right? But I mean, maybe
yeah,
it's possible.
Right. No, I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. I won't, maybe I'll save for the parrot room what my example would be.
Okay.
I'm submitting to the superego. Yeah. So for the second half, for patrons, although people can probably guess. All right. So how is it then? Okay. So what is the difference, and according to Freud, between the preconscious and the unconscious?
All right. So the difference would be this. So if I said to you, who's the 16th president of the United States, right? Like, you would know, right? Like, it's Abraham Lincoln. Like, you,
right.
You don't have Abraham Lincoln.
I should know that, but I forgot what number was with Abraham Lincoln.
Okay. I was trying. Yeah. But whatever. I mean,
if you said who got, you know, shot in the Ford Theater, I would have known.
Right. Okay. So that's what we'll say. Who got shot in Ford Theater during Our American Cousin, right? So,
So
that you weren't consciously thinking about it prior to me asking that question, but it was in your pre-consciousness. So it didn't take anything for you to bring it up, right? Like, that's that's pre-conscious. Like, it doesn't, there's no barrier between that thought and coming to consciousness. Whereas if I said to you, when did you walk in on your parents having sex or whatever, you know, like something that like gets into your unconscious, then
the first time or
yeah,
no.
right. So you have to make a joke, right? So that's that's the sign that we've touched on unconscious. Like, it can't just make this easy. You can't just say like, oh, when I was seven, it was nothing. It was fine. Like, you joke about it, or you like say like, oh, I don't know, I don't remember, that never happened. Oh my God. How could you even ask that? Like, all those things indicate that we're on the level of the unconscious. So that's for Freud the difference. Like, one can just pass right through to consciousness, and the other one gets, and then has to get a kind of diverted path to get there.
Okay. So that's the unconscious but you're saying that I actually do know or have a memory of encountering my parents in the act of lovemaking.
Well, I was just throwing something out there.
Right. No. It's not an innocent example, because it's really not from Freud, right?
Right. Freud especially, right?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, it was kind of like a Freudian joke.
Almost. Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. I mean, it's clearly a you're not actually talking about my parents, but the point is, you know, there are traumatic events,
right,
like that, and that would be probably the definitive one for. According to Freud, or maybe that we somehow are assumed to have experienced, to have defined the unconscious. So like when I'm just, maybe this is what's called resistance right now popping up in this conversation, but it seems to me like in order for there to be this unconscious, there has to be knowledge there or memory there that's being repressed. That they're right. I know who the president was during the Civil War without having, you know, without being conscious of it before being asked, that I'm walking around with knowledge about traumatic events that I have repressed and that are in the unconscious. Is that
right? That's Freud's idea.
Okay. And according to Freud, there are some that we can just sort of assume that every person has had.
Right. That's why I chose that example. Right.
Right. Because that's the universal example. Yeah. I mean, of course, there would be examples where that didn't happen. The mother or father died or, you know, whatever. But right. The father died during childbirth. That happened all the time.
All the time.
He was killed. Now Lacan comes along and does Lacan have a different theory of the unconscious where you don't have to?
No, I think, for both Freud and Lacan, repression constitutes part of the unconscious, but it doesn't constitute all of the unconscious. Like, and I think Lacan maybe develops this a little bit more, as you're suggesting, that for Lacan, it's actually the imposition of law or, you know, like art or symbolic identity that itself gets, that also is unconscious, right? And this relates a little bit more to superego. So we're unconscious of the way in which we're subjected to the law or subjected to the demands of the social order. Like we're heeding them and we're responding to them in some way, but we're unconscious of that, of the way in which we're doing that. And for Lacan, we're especially unconscious of our own desire. So Freud doesn't ever use the term desire, right? It would be something like Forderung in German. He uses it occasionally, but mostly he uses the German term Wunsch in interpretive terms, which just means wish, right? So, but Lacan reads Freud's notion of repression of desire and reads unconscious desire into that. And so for Lacan, our desire is necessarily unconscious. So he makes this distinction. I think this is really important and interesting, between our conscious wishes and our unconscious desire. And that, so whatever we can consciously wish for, we wish for, you know, they're always pleasant or they're things that contribute to our good, right? Our self-interest. But then our unconscious desire subverts that. So there's a kind of struggle within the psyche between the conscious wishes, which are trying to advance our self-interest, and our unconscious desire, which is undermining it all along. So that's for Lacan the way. So you're right to say that's a little bit different than Freud's theory of the unconscious, which is, he doesn't have quite this rigid separation between conscious wish and unconscious desire.
Are our desires that are unconscious always related to or coming out of some sort of trauma, like encountering your parents while they're in the act of making love?
Well, insofar as for Lacan, our very constitution as speaking beings is traumatic, the answer is yes, right? Like, and you can think about this, for me, it's easy because it was really traumatic for me, like going to school for the first time, right? Like you have to, you're encountering the other, you don't know what the other wants, you don't know how you're supposed to act. Like that for Lacan is that there's something traumatic about that. And your desire emerges out of your unconscious interpretation of what you think others want you to do. So for Lacan, your unconscious is he even says the unconscious desire is interpretation. So it is how you interpret what this scene you come across on a social scene, and then you interpret it, and you're trying to make sense of what you're supposed to, how you're supposed to fit in, what you're supposed to do. And that's the way your unconscious manifests itself.
Okay. And it manifests itself in those scenes as some sort of desire.
Right. Which for was, him, for right. desire. Right. As, yeah, as right. a desire. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the process of psychoanalysis is to partly to discover what those desires are.
Correct. Right. Exactly. So you're trying to say like, this is my desire, right? Like you, like your own desire is alien to you. And so because it's unconscious. And so process of psychoanalysis is to name that, like, I am the truth of my desire, something like that, right? Like I'm trying to discover what it is that, where my desire is in the world, like what it mm-hmm. is that, you know, because I know what my conscious wish is, but I don't, but my, that's not my unconscious desire. And so I have to recognize the way that this thing that's alien, that feels alien inside of me, is actually from me.
So like when I was a younger man and I was first starting out, my wish was to publish short fiction and then a novel, right? Yeah. I thought I'd mm-hmm. be a great American novelist, and I wished to be one. But my desire, would it have been in opposition to that, or would it have been to the side of that, or right. you know, would it
somewhere askew of that, right? So right. it could have been even to fail at doing that. Like I think that's right. what often our desire is, right? Like it's to, like we set up this goal, whatever it is, like some kind of like conscious goal, and then our unconscious desire is to fail at that thing, right? Like, or it can even be to succeed at it in a way that's painful to us, right? That causes us to, like, we set up this conscious goal that we think will bring us like whatever pleasure, and then the real result is that it brings us suffering, and we're like, well, why did that happen? Like so even when we get what we think we consciously wish for, it can fulfill our unconscious desire when it actually is under, like what we consciously wish for isn't really what we thought it would be, right? Like it's undermining us.
Okay, so now,
yeah,
I want to know, is the superego the source of our desire?
Okay,
No.
So super, okay. So this is an interesting question, I think, and a lot of people theorize about this. I have my own particular way of theorizing about it. So I think that what superego does is that it hijacks our desire and it places it in the service of some social demand, right? So let's just take the capitalist demand to accumulate. Like it takes our desire and it puts it in service of that, rather than, like, our desire is inherently subversive, right? It's inherently undermining, like, the demands of the society. Like it's responding to them, but never,
because our wishes are maybe aligned,
correct,
with the demands of our society. Like right, wanting to right. be a novelist is sure. It's a social good. It's not, sure. you know, it's right. maybe a little egotistical, but it helps
the society, right? Like you'd be successful. You'd give people stuff to do. You'd make money for publishing companies. It'd be mm-hmm. great. Right. Mm-hmm. So you're right. Our wishes are almost always social goods, even if they're egotistical. That's a really good way to put it. Mm-hmm. But our desire usually isn't. Like our desire usually undermines, I'm tempted to say always undermines, the social good and our own good. And so superego hijacks that and then puts it in the service of that social demand. So it takes our self-destructiveness and it causes it to feed the structure of the social order, the capitalist system in this case, right? So mm-hmm. that I think is, and I think, again, I think capitalism is the most superegoic system that the earth has known hitherto, right? Like it really, like other systems were much more, there's much more, the law is in effect and superego, like there's a kind of dialectic between, the more the law is developed and strong, the less the superego, and the less the law is really felt on your
so you gave an example from Lost Highway of like a superego in action, where the mafia boss pulls another, like smashes into another car, pushes the other car off the road, drags a driver from the car, and then proceeds to lecture him about tailgating.
As he's smashing his face in, right.
Smashing his face in and pointing a gun at him and threatening him and hurting him. He's saying, you know, You could have, you know, run into me. You were too close. Yeah. You need to read the driver's manual.
Get a fucking manual and read that son of a bitch.
Yeah, right. And you know how many people die in the highways every year is because of assholes like you.
Right.
But obviously, so the desire to be violent.
Yeah.
And to destroy is being put into service by the superego
right.
of a social good.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Isn't that a great example of that? Right.
Yeah.
Like he's telling her, get a manual, like stop killing people, stop threatening people on the road, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. But the reason it's from the superego is because the desire wins out over the social good. It's not the social good aspect is sort of a charade.
Right. Well, it's just like, right. The both are at work, right? Like it's a, like both manifest themselves, right? Like the, you're right though, that the, that in a way that figure is getting off on the punishment, not the social good, right? The social good's kind of an excuse.
You need both though, because
you need both, right?
Without this justification of the social good, then the realization of one's own sadistic impulses can't be avoided.
That's right. So superego, like it's this diversion. I actually think that superego is the biggest barrier to leftist action, right? Like that it's this diversion of potentially radical energy, for lack of a better word, or a radical desire into a something socially useful, right?
Do you want to say radical desire? Because desire is always self-undermining. Desire is not.
No, but I think that's radical. I think that's radical. Like, I think self-under... Like, I don't think, I have a kind of a weird blend of Marxism and psychoanalysis, right?
Right. No. And you're not the only one, by the way. That's been Marxism since World War II. That's all Marxism has been.
I know. But for someone like Marcuse, right? Like, he wants to, he thinks that this, we have to find a way to get over our self-undermining. He thinks that's a problem that we have to try to, that a socialist society will allow us to get out of. And I kind of think, no, it's the opposite. The problem is that capitalism diverts our self-undermining into this productive kind of accumulative schema. And so it doesn't allow us to confront it directly. And for my vision, whatever, some kind of socialist society would be one where that self-undermining is made, allowed to be front and center, not diverted into this productivity of accumulation of a bunch of waste.
Let me ask you about desire again to see if I can understand what you're getting at. There's something traumatic that we repress. And our desires emerge from that act of repression.
Yeah.
We have wishes, which may or may not be superego injunctions, right? If they're just straightforward wishes, like I want to be a novelist, then they're maybe not from the superego, although they might be.
They could just be from the society, right? Like the society lays out all these things that you can want, and you want some of them.
Right. Yeah. But the desire is going to, but the desire comes along based on your trauma. And that trauma, according to Lacan, is just the trauma of self-consciousness.
Right. The trauma.
It doesn't have to be the primal scene.
No, it doesn't have to be anything like that. Right. It can just be the confrontation with the other. Like I confront all these people that, like, what do they want from me? Like, that's what Lacan's famous way of putting it. Right.
It's, that is the only path towards self-awareness.
That's right.
Animals don't have this problem of desire because they don't have self-consciousness. They don't have this bind.
Right.
Of alienated from the world.
That's right. They might have it, but they haven't told us so far. So that's all I can say about that. They haven't told us. I mean, maybe
I would say on, you know, some quiet evenings when I'm alone with my cat, I've thought that my cat was acting in such a way to communicate her self-awareness and her neurosis. The neurosis.
No, Doug, I think that's I think that's very well put. I think that we neuroticize pets, especially all the time. I think that happens all the time, right?
So, yeah.
You know, I our cat acts neurotically, like, you know, like the way that like they'll be conditioned to like our cat even, you know, maybe I'm sure you've seen this too in a cat, like they'll desire what they or want what they don't really desire. Like there's this kind of right. dynamic of desire and want even in the animal. So when a pet, so I think that that's completely true that once animals exist within this signifying relation, like in the home or whatever, then they can be subject to the same neurotic impulses that.
Right. Humans. Right. Okay. So now that the wishes of society are not products of our traumatic self-awareness.
Right, right, right. They're just out there. They're just available to us, kind of givens of the society. Right.
Right.
Like be an entrepreneur, be an inventor, be a novelist, be a movie director, whatever they are. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, okay. And so the self-awareness, when you become self-aware of society, you kind of become critical of right. the givens. You have right. to become critical of the givens, right?
Right.
Right. So now I'm going to ask about Zizek. What about this idea of over-identification, which would be like over-identification with a given?
Yeah.
Not with your desire, but with like, okay, I'm going to be a novelist. I'm not going to have this other side of myself where I'm a regular guy who likes chocolate cake and,
right.
you know, but I'm just a novelist through and through. And through that, that over-identification, then you sort of, that ends up subverting the category.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that seems fine to me that I just, it's never really, that idea of his is never real. I'm not sure if it appeals to him, frankly, because.
Anymore, like, right? That was a phase maybe.
Right. It was maybe a phase, but also, you know, I think what it is is a rejection of the way in which, you know, like the executive who fires 1,000 people on Zoom in the morning, then goes to a Zen meditation in the afternoon, right? Like I think that's what that idea is trying to attack. This idea that, everyone, like even the most exploiting scum capitalists have a human side and he wants to say, I think, like, no, you really just are the scum capitalist. You're not you don't get to have the other side too. And I think that's what he was trying to,
And he also said the thing that's most important about himself is his public persona and all the little personal details and the facts of his particular biography are the least interesting or least real things about him, but he said that. I mean, he likes to say things. So.
I know. I mean, I just think he says a lot of. I mean, I say a lot of things too. So I don't hold that.
Okay. Wait, I'm going to go back to the superego because.
But no, let me just answer that because I think it's interesting. Like I think that he, you know, like he'll say these things like, I hate students. I just know it's not. I've seen how he interacts with students and being like incredibly generous with his time. So I just think it's just not true. Like and I think it's true about, I mean, I think he would want to say what's important is the public, my thought and my own little personal quirks, who cares? And I think that's true. Like, I think, you know, what matters about a thinker is what they're thinking and not their little private idiosyncrasies. Like that seems like uncontroversial.
In private, when I was working as a publishing manager, and I'm sure I'll return to this when I'm, next year, when I start publishing books again, I used to tell people that my least favorite kind of person was an author, that I hated authors and I thought they were all egomaniacs and they should leave me alone. And then I would add, and when I was an author, I was absolutely the worst kind of author that there could be. Right?
Yeah.
But today I talked to somebody who was an author I'd worked for, and he said, I just want you to know, I really appreciate how kind you were to me and how much effort you put into publicizing my book and how you got, you know, and I was like, I guess I did that. secretly in my heart of heart, my superego was telling me to do something else. So the superego, back to that. So desire is subversive and could help us change and transform
Society. Yes.
Superego is an impediment to desire because of the way it's connected to social injunctions, demands. Like normative demands.
Yep.
Okay. But the normative demands themselves are not necessarily an impediment to radical change.
Well, that's interesting. Why do you say that? Like, isn't the normative, like, it depends.
Because
like,
the super, well, the part of the, just giving the example from Lost Highway, there's nothing particularly wrong or backwards or about someone insisting that you not tailgate, or that the rule of how far back you should drive from another car.
Yeah.
That's a perfectly good rule.
It's a good rule.
And it has a function, and to not do it isn't subverting.
Not at all. No, right? I know. You know what? Now, Doug, you've made me think that that's a terrible example of superego.
Oh, really?
Yeah. For this reason, because I think, to me, and I wonder what you think about this, I think there's a radical difference between law like that, like law, and even like more, like, is tailgating a law or is it a more?
I think there's a law. I mean, I think you can get a ticket.
Yeah, so it is a law, right? So
right.
To me, there's a radical difference between law, especially laws, like obviously law can be oppressive in certain ways, right? Mm-hmm. Like laws, if anti-abortion laws in Texas, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a radical difference between law and what I want to call like social imperative or social demand, which I think in capitalist society is almost just a singular kind of imperative, which is accumulate, don't let anything get in the way of your accumulating, right? Like something like that. And I think that kind of demand can never be emancipatory. But I think you're right to say that law certainly can be. But I think that superego is attached to this demand, not to law necessarily. That's why I was saying maybe it's a bad example, because I think that like one of the, it's interesting because we often think that Freud said superego is internalized law. He didn't say that. He said it's internalized injunction of the social authority. That is not law, right? So that I think is a real important difference. And that's why I think superego can't be, and I think social injunctions cannot be emancipatory. But like law or even something like mores, like civility, those kind of things, I think can be. Like, I think that's what you're, like, I would go beyond, like even, like, polite driving, whatever. Like, that, I think, is surely, I mean, like, in our socialist society, we're going to have polite, everybody's going to be a polite driver, right? So,
yeah. We've got two viewers, and one of them, I just have to flash this on the screen, appropriate number of viewers for this shithead. I don't know which one of us is a shithead, according to John McCain's ghost.
Oh, that's terrible.
So we're being haunted by some Republican ghost.
Yeah.
But I wanted to flash that on the screen just to say I don't know what you're talking about, John McCain. But okay, so I'm going to go one last time around. So like... the problem with the superego is the way it's an expression of authority and power without reason, without
that's good.
Reference to an external reason, but for its own sake.
That's right. So it's just it's for its own sake. It's a senseless imperative, right? So it's, which is why Freud describes it. He says the more you, and I love this description of it. And is this how you know you're in? Caught up in the logic of superego, he says, the more you capitulate, the more it demands, right?
Right.
It's unlike the law in that way, right? Like if you drive under the speed limit, you're just under the speed limit. It's fine, right? Like
someone else said, Matt Beasley said, very excited to see you with Todd McGowan again.
That's nice.
So I want to, and then he told me, what about my nice comment, Doug? So I had to point out it was not aimed at you, Todd. That was maybe my superego was saying, you should let Todd know someone said he was a shithead.
I assumed it was about me. So
I assumed it was about me, though.
Okay,
there we go.
There we go.
Keep going.
Good masochistic subject. So I think that that's really the key, right? Like the superego, the more you do what it says, it adds even more. And this is why, I don't know if you remember this guy, you probably read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God when you were in eighth grade or something. But this Jonathan Edwards, this famous American Puritan, this notion that he says, like, I am the, he's like this incredible Christian, right? And he says, I am in my heart the worst sinner of all. And why does he think that? Because he's so caught up in the logic of superego, even though he just has one little sexual thought in his head. He's like, oh my God, like that's, I'm the, like, the more you try to get out of it, the more it demands of you. And I think that's how you know that more, always more, that's the logic of superego. And that's why it can't be emancipatory, because it's a trap that you can't get out of.
Right. Right. So that self-destructive streak, though, doesn't originate in the id or in the desire or out of the trauma of just self-consciousness. It is coming from the external society?
Well, no, I would say that our desire is inherently in some way self-destructive. But it gets, the point of superego is that it then gets deviated through this social imperative into something that keeps the society going.
Okay. So
rather than
if it didn't have the superego, then you would have to, and you acted out on your desire, you would then be faced with this, the way it was self-destructive.
Right. And you'd have to, and then that would be the, could be the basis for some kind of social change, right?
Change.
Like that's, yeah.
Or personal change.
Or either way.
Right.
Well, I think each implies the other. And for me, I would
right,
say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Like, I don't think there's a personal change that doesn't have a corresponding, like, I don't think there's a personal emancipation. I don't think there's, you know, I don't know who, I think it's Adorno, who says no satisfaction for one without the satisfaction of all. And I don't like Adorno, but I kind of like that idea.
So, like, instead of saying, well, kid, I have to spank you in order to teach you a lesson about how to, you know, keep your room clean, which is a superego move, right?
Yeah.
You would just raise your hand in anger and then see, oh, I wanted to hit my kid.
Right. Right.
Right. And that's a completely different kind
of
moment.
Right. Right.
So you take away the justification. You take away the mask.
That's absolutely right. Right. You take away, right, the social justification for that activity.
So I still wonder, I want to explore a little bit more for a moment why it is that we're so full of self-destruction and destruction.
Sure.
I'm coming to realize that it's true.
That's the thing. You live long enough and you're confronted with this.
Right. You know, the most kind people who never seem like they would hurt a fly can end up through maybe the superego acting in incredibly aggressive ways.
Well, I would just say this, that, you know, who says they would never hurt a fly? Norman Bates at the end of Psycho, which I think tells the whole story.
Right.
So I would just say, I think here's like, let me see if I can lay this out. Why I think this is right. And I don't think this is in Freud or Lacan. I think it's implied, but not fully laid out. And this is what I would say, that there aren't, like, our desire doesn't have just objects readily available to it, right? Like, there's nothing that just is inherently desirable for us, because we're drawn to what is missing. Like, we're drawn, and that's because of the fact that we're speaking beings, and I think our cats have this logic they've bought into. So we're drawn to what's missing. And so there's this impulse to self-destruction in order to create something missing. And I think that's what we, because it gives us something to enjoy, something to desire. So when we are being hard on ourselves, when we're cutting into ourselves in some way, we're really forging a kind of way for ourselves to desire. And that's why when things are going great, what do? We always find a way to kind of make them not go so great anymore, so that we can start desiring again. Like, that's how it's a kind of like kickstarting our desire by undermining ourselves in some way. So that's why I think there's something really, you know, vital about this self-undermining. Like, it's how we keep ourselves going in the world.
Right. I went out on a date last night with a woman who was a college professor in literature, and I asked her, and then she later in life quit that and became a lawyer.
Wow.
And I asked her, why did you do that? What made you decide to leave your professorship and take up being a lawyer for people who were being evicted? And she said, well, I was getting really close to getting tenure. That was her answer. I was getting very close to getting tenure at the university. And
that's a
great
answer.
That.
Yeah, that's a great answer. It's funny. the woman who is the, who, so my twin boys were, Hillary couldn't carry them. So somebody had to, we had to, my sister-in-law carried them.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the exact same thing. She was on her way to become a music professor, a tenured music professor. Mm-hmm. She quit the tenure track line right before she'd get tenure. And now she works as a lecturer in the same department on like a non-tenure track. And I just think it's sad, but it's such a great example of the way desire works, right? Like she got to that point and then just undermined it. And then she got to a place where she's always going to wish that she could be a tenure track professor, but
right.
Gave it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great that that was her first answer to that question.
Yeah. Like, that was her answer. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that she decided at the end of the date not to see me again, I think is the same thing in action. She's putting up a barrier for,
because yes.
She was so satisfied.
Yeah. It's just
that
too
first
much
date.
For her. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So
that's pretty good.
All right. So I think now is a good point for us to end this first half in about 5 to 10 minutes. I'll send you a second link. If that won't be on Twitch, it's going to just be for patrons only. And, and that one we'll talk about like some of the ways that the superego was being acted out. We did this now already, but some of the other ways that the superego function might be acting on society under COVID and,
okay.
About Trump and that kind of thing.
Great. That'd be fun.